Welcome to 30 Minutes of VOA Learning English, the Voice of America's information service for people learning English. Join us now for the Education Report and the Making of a Nation, coming up after As It Is.
Hello and welcome back. You have come to the right place if you want to improve your American English skills and hear what is happening in our world at the same time. This is As It Is from VOA Learning English in Washington. Today, we turn our attention to Iraq, the Middle Eastern country that is once again faced with great violence. President Obama has made a decision about new U.S. involvement. We'll tell you what his plans are and what may happen next. Then, the curious world of those tiny creatures we see almost every day in almost every place on the planet. Scientists are learning some very interesting things about, are you ready for this, ants. Our writers and editors have been working especially hard to put together today's edition of As It Is. Now, on to part one. President Barack Obama is sending hundreds of troops to Iraq to help the country's armed forces stop unrest. The Obama administration now faces questions on whether the troop deployment will lead to a full-fledged or expanded involvement in Iraq. VOA White House correspondent Luis Ramirez is following the president. Jonathan Evans has his report.
Sunni Muslim rebels in Iraq are tightening their control of more towns. Some observers question whether the deployment of up to 300 military advisors may be too little, too late. The advisors are meant to give the Iraqi government the support it needs to end the rebellion. President Obama sent Secretary of State John Kerry to Iraq earlier this week. He told Mr. Kerry to push for unity against the Islamist rebels and for an Iraqi solution. Josh Earnest is the president's spokesman.
This administration does believe that there is time for Iraq's political leaders to make the necessary decisions that will unify the country to confront the terrorist threat, the extremist threat that they're facing in Iraq right now.
The job of the United States advisors is to study the abilities of the Iraqi military. Many Iraqi soldiers reportedly have left the military, and the remaining soldiers are said to hold a low opinion of the force. In addition to the U.S. advisors, the president has approved other orders. He told up to 275 troops to protect the United States Embassy and other American interest in Iraq. Julian Zelzer teaches political history at Princeton University in New Jersey. He told VOA on Skype that it may be difficult for the Obama administration to keep the number of U.S. troops in Iraq low.
Once you send 300 people there, at a minimum, if they recommend the need for more, it's hard for the president to then ignore the very people he sent to find out what should be done.
Professor Zelzer says past conflicts have shown how small deployments can lead to much bigger operations. He notes what happened to the United States in Vietnam and Korea.
Each time the mission gets bigger, the involvement gets bigger, it's very difficult to contain these situations.
The situation in Iraq has worsened in recent weeks. The United States has already made a big investment in the country. The challenge to limit U.S. involvement is perhaps even greater. I'm Jonathan Evans.
Scientists have always been interested in the high level of organization in ant societies. American researchers have watched ants build life-saving rafts to keep afloat during floods. They also have documented how ant colonies choose their next queen, the female whose job is to produce eggs. New technology is helping to improve researchers' understanding of the insects. But as we hear from Bob Doty, there is still a lot to be learned.
Fire ants living in Brazilian forests are perfectly at home in an environment where flooding is common. To save themselves, the insects connect their legs together and create floating rafts. Some ant rafts can be up to 20 centimeters wide. David Hu is a mechanical engineer with the Georgia Institute of Technology, also known as Georgia Tech. He says ants know how to join together tightly.
And you can imagine you have 100 ants, which means 600 legs. 99% of those legs will be connected to a neighbor. So they're very, very good at maintaining this network.
David Hu and other Georgia Tech researchers wanted to study ants and the secret of their engineering. They froze ant rafts and looked at them with the help of computer technology, or CT images. The pictures showed that larger ants serve in central positions to which smaller ants hold. The larger ants form pockets of air that keep the insects afloat. Scientists say small robots or materials that can change shape could be programmed in a similar way, working towards a shared goal. Researchers at North Carolina State University are also studying ants. They examined how Indian jumping ants choose the leader of the colony when they lose their top female or queen. Researcher Clint Pennock says all the worker ants in the colony are females. His team found that the work ants start a series of competitions, or battles. The team found that some workers become physically larger, and that led to the release of chemicals in the insects.
Within a matter of days, we see changes in dopamine in the brain that we think are linked to the reproduction that starts in these workers.
Soon, the winning ant starts developing ovaries, the organs required to produce eggs, while its brain decreases in size. The winning ant also begins standing taller and generally lives three times as long as the other ants. Scientists say this behavior and the release of neural hormones are the result of genetic orders. Scientists say the new findings may help researchers better understand the link between hormones and genes in human beings. I'm Bob Doty.
So let's see. We've given you the big picture, unrest in Iraq, and the little picture, ants. And now it's time for a little bit of American history. You may find it hard to believe, but there was once a time, and not too long ago, when there was no color television. That's right, all you saw were pictures in black and white. But on this date, in 1951, CBS, a large American network, sent a four-hour program to stations in New York City, Baltimore, Maryland, Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, and Washington, D.C., in color. It was an experiment, since no one owned television sets at the time that could receive a color picture. Look how far we have come. Born on this date in 1924 was a man who brought lots of color and drama and excitement to the big screen. Film director Sidney Lumet made such great films as Long Day's Journey into Night, Failsafe, Serpico, 12 Angry Men, Dog Day Afternoon, and The Verdict.
Watching classic movies is a good way to learn about life in the United States. Well, that's all for today. But stay with us because two more Learning English shows are almost on the air. And there is world news at the beginning of the hour. You are listening to VOA, Washington.
The Education Report is next, followed by The Making of a Nation. You can read and listen to our programs and download MP3s at learningenglish.voanews.com. You can learn with us on Facebook, Twitter, and YouTube at VOA Learning English.
This is the VOA Learning English Education Report. Millions of high school students in China took a college entrance examination recently. The highly competitive test is often praised for giving good students a chance to enter the best schools. It makes the competition for college fairer for students from poor families. The examination is known as the Gaokao. Universities are supposed to require good scores on the test for admission to college. But reports suggest that some people are getting into schools without even taking the test. Education is very important to gaining a good standing in Chinese society. This year, about 9 million students competed for about 7 million places in colleges. Every June, Chinese media report on the hard work and worry of students preparing for the Gaokao. This year, however, newspapers are writing stories about corruption in the country's top schools. One case involves Chai Rongsheng, the former head of admissions at Beijing's highly respected Renmin University. Mr. Chai reportedly took money in exchange for approving admissions for students who did not take the Gaokao. Yang Roy studies Chinese education policy at the University of Hong Kong. He says the Gaokao offered millions of people chances for a better life. And Mr. Yang says it changed the country after the late 1970s.
But increasingly, academics and government policymakers realize that Gaokao is not really fair. You know, many people are in much better position than those in rural, for example, schools. And also, schools themselves only cannot tell the whole picture.
Some universities in China are permitted to choose up to 5% of their first-year students for reasons other than schoolwork. These could include sports, interest groups, or community volunteer work. The policy is designed to help candidates whose abilities were not identifiable from Gaokao test scores. Schools also have had more freedom to choose candidates from rural areas. Xiang Bangqi is vice president of the 21st Century Education Research Institute, a non-governmental group. He proposes other ways to get different kinds of students. He says students should be nominated by their high schools, then take examinations at the university. Finally, a person would be offered a place at the school through performance records. Mr. Xiang says instead, administrators with power to decide who enters college have hijacked the system. Officials have banned trading university entry for money or better treatment. Earlier this year, the Ministry of Education demanded a more open and better supervised admission system. And that's the Education Report from VOA Learning English. I'm Jerry Watson. ¶¶
VOA Learning English. Welcome to The Making of a Nation, our weekly program of American history for people learning American English. I'm Steve Ember. The 1850s were an increasingly tense time in the United States. Most of the population lived east of the Mississippi River, but more and more people were moving west. As western areas became populated, they became official territories and then new states. The settlement of these areas once again raised the issue of slavery. A law passed in 1820 called the Missouri Compromise extended a line across the map of the United States. Slavery was legal in areas south of the line. North of the line, slavery was illegal except in the state of Missouri. 30 years later, another political compromise made slavery a local issue instead of a national one. The Compromise of 1850 said people in the Western territories could decide for themselves whether slavery would be legal or illegal. Then, in 1854, Illinois Senator Stephen Douglas proposed another measure. His legislation would also affect slavery. It aimed to make the wild western area known as Nebraska an official territory.
This is the Great Plains. This is open territory. There were Indian tribes settled out there.
Nicole Etchison is an historian. She says white settlers could not move to Nebraska because a government did not yet exist there. They wanted the U.S. Congress to open the area to settlers. Investors wanted Congress to act, too, so Nebraska could support a railroad. Nebraska lies north of the line drawn by the Missouri Compromise of 1820. As a result, slavery would be banned in the territory. But slavery was permitted in the state next to Nebraska, Missouri. Slaveholders in Missouri did not want Nebraska to become a free territory. They were afraid their slaves would flee to it. They felt threatened by the free states and territories around them. So Senator Douglas proposed that the large Nebraska area be split in two. The northern part would be known as the Nebraska Territory. The southern part, next to Missouri, would be known as the Kansas Territory. The senator said that settlers in both territories had the right to decide whether their lands would accept slavery. He argued that the Compromise of 1850 had given the same right to people in two other territories, New Mexico and Utah. And he claimed that same right was meant for the people of all future territories. Douglas noted that in the past, the federal government sought to divide free states from slave states by making a line across a map. He said, dividing up land was not the answer. He said the people in a state or territory had the right to decide for themselves. This right was known as popular sovereignty. Historian Nicole Etchison says popular sovereignty required faith in the American political process.
Stephen Douglas argued that the foundation of American political philosophy is that the people get to decide. The voters get to decide issues, and there was no reason why they couldn't decide the slavery issue, just like they decided any other political issue.
Douglas argued that the Compromise of 1850 took the place of the Missouri Compromise of 1820. The new Kansas-Nebraska Act, he said, simply recognized the fact that the Missouri Compromise was dead. A number of anti-slavery senators denounced the Kansas-Nebraska bill. They said it was part of a Southern plan to spread slavery wherever possible. They also said Stephen Douglas was using the measure for political purposes. They said he wanted to be president and was hoping to influence voters in Southern states. Opposition to the Kansas-Nebraska bill was extremely strong in the northern states. In city after city, large public gatherings were held. Businessmen organized many of the meetings. They were angry at Douglas because he had reopened the dispute about slavery. They feared that the dispute would hurt the nation's economy. Northern religious leaders also united against the bill. Thousands signed protests and sent them to Congress. Douglas criticized the clergymen. He said they should stay out of politics. In the southern United States, the Kansas-Nebraska Act caused little excitement. Most Southerners were not interested in it. They believed the measure might help the cause of slavery, but they also believed it might lead to trouble. President Franklin Pierce did not like the bill. He feared it would reopen the bitter national debate about slavery. However, most members of the U.S. Senate supported the Kansas-Nebraska bill. It passed easily in the Senate. The bill had less support in the House of Representatives. The vote there was close, but the measure passed. President Pierce finally agreed to sign it into law. In exchange, congressional leaders promised to approve several presidential appointments. Supporters of the Kansas-Nebraska Act celebrated its passage. They fired cannons as the city of Washington was waking to a new day. Two senators who opposed the bill heard the noise as they walked down the steps of the Capitol building. One of them said, "They celebrate a victory now, but the echoes they awake will never rest until slavery itself is dead." The new law gave the people of Kansas and Nebraska the right to decide if slavery would be legal or illegal. The vote would depend on who settled in the territories. It was not likely that people who owned slaves would settle in Nebraska. However, there was a good chance slave owners would settle in Kansas. Groups in the South organized quickly to help pro-slavery settlers move to Kansas. At the same time, groups in the North helped free state settlers move to Kansas. Historian Nicole Etchison says some of these settlers were abolitionists who believed slavery was wrong, but many were simply white farmers looking for new lands to settle. Ms. Etchison says these farmers did not care about slavery, but they did not want to live near blacks or compete with slave labor.
It's that third group of Midwesterners who becomes crucial, because when they get out there to Kansas and they can't get a fair vote, they become radicalized against slavery.
In Washington, President Pierce appointed Andrew Reeder as governor of the Kansas Territory. Pro-slavery settlers urged Reeder to hold immediate elections for a territorial legislature. They believed they were in the majority. They wanted a vote before too many free state settlers moved in. Governor Reeder rejected the demands. He decided to hold an election but only for a territorial representative to the National Congress. On Election Day, hundreds of men from Missouri crossed the border into Kansas. They voted illegally, and the pro-slavery candidate won. The same thing happened when Kansas finally held an election for a legislature. Once again, men from Missouri crossed the border into Kansas. Many of them carried guns. They forced election officials to count their illegal votes. As a result, almost every pro-slavery candidate was elected to the new legislature. Nicole Etchison says many American elections in the 1800s had examples of violence, bad behavior, and wrongdoing. But the pro-slavery Missourians were extreme.
It was obvious that there was egregious fraud in the elections in Kansas Territory.
She says population counts at the time showed fewer than 3,000 voters in Kansas Territory. But pro-slavery candidates received up to 6,000 votes. The governor ordered an investigation. The investigation showed evidence of wrongdoing in six areas. New elections were held in those areas. This time, when only legal votes were counted, many of the pro-slavery candidates were defeated. Yet there were still enough pro-slavery candidates to hold a majority. Andrew Reeder understood he was governing a bitterly divided territory. He wanted to warn President Pierce about what was happening. So Reeder went to Washington. He met with Pierce almost every day for 2 weeks. He described how pro-slavery groups in Missouri were interfering in Kansas. He said if the state of Missouri refused to deal with the troublemakers, then the national government must deal with them. He asked the president to do something. Pierce agreed that Kansas was a serious problem. He seemed ready to act. Reeder returned home and opened the first meeting of the territorial legislature. The pro-slavery majority quickly voted to move to a town close to the Missouri border. It also approved several pro-slavery measures. Governor Reeder vetoed these bills, but the legislature rejected his veto and passed the new laws. The Kansas legislature also sent a message to President Pierce. It wanted him to remove Reeder as governor. Political pressure was strong, and the president agreed. He named a new governor, Wilson Shannon. Shannon supported the pro-slavery laws of the legislature. He also said Kansas should become a slave state like Missouri. Kansas settlers, who had voted against slavery, became extremely angry. Soon, the situation became violent. The events known as Bleeding Kansas will be our story next week. I'm Steve Ember, inviting you to join us next time for The Making of a Nation, American History, from VOA Learning English.